version of the story, watching as his smile was extinguished by disbelief and then concern.
"Geez, that's terrible," he said, and then he caught my expression. "Wait a minute. Why, look at me. I hope you don't think I had anything to do with it."
"It just seems odd there wasn't any problem until you showed up. Johnny died 4 months ago. You blow in last week, and now Chester's suddenly got problems."
"Come on. Hey, I was sitting in the bar last night watching big screen TV. You can ask anyone."
"Mind if I sit?"
"Sure, go ahead. Take the good one. I'll take this."
There was one hard wooden chair and one upholstered chair. Ray steered me toward the latter and took the wooden chair for himself. He placed his hands on his knees, rubbing the fabric as if his palms were sweating.
"I'm probably the oldest and best friend Johnny ever had. I'd never do anything to mess with his son or his grandson or anything like that. You have to believe me."
"I'm not accusing you, Ray."
"Sure sounds like that to me."
"If I thought you'd broken in, I probably wouldn't have come up here. I'd have gone to the cops and had him dust for prints."
"They didn't do that?"
"Chester can't be sure anything was taken, which means it wasn't even a burglary as far as the cops are concerned. The techs here only lift prints at the scene of a major crime. Felonies, not misdemeanors. Malicious mischief wouldn't qualify unless thousands of dollars worth of damage had been done, which wasn't true in this case."
What I didn't bother to say was the procedure is lengthy, and the department is perpetually backed up. 3 weeks is standard. In a rush situation, prints could be lifted, photographed, and traced, with the resultant tracings being faxed to CalID in Sacramento. The turnaround time could be a day or two. In this case, we didn't even have a suspect. Except maybe him, I thought. I watched him, acutely aware of the key in my pocket. I didn't want him to know about that just yet. He seemed like a man who had something on his mind, and I wanted to hear his tale before I told him mine.
"What's in Ashland?" I asked.
There was a millisecond's pause.
"I got family back there."
Was Johnny really in the service?
"I have no idea. I already told you. I lost track of him for years."
"How'd you connect up again?"
"Johnny got in touch."
"How'd he know where to find you?"
Impatience flashed across his face as if his picture were being taken.
"Because he had my address." "What is this? I don't have to answer this stuff. It's none of your damn business."
"I'm just trying to get to the bottom of this."
"Well, try somewhere else."
Chester thinks Johnny was a spy during World War II, some kind of double agent for the Japanese. Ray rolled his eyes briefly and then gave his head a quick shake.
"Where'd he get that?"
"It's too complicated to explain. He says the old man was very paranoid. He thinks that's part of it." Ray said,
"The old guy was paranoid, but it didn't have anything to do with the Japs."
"What then?"
"Why should I tell you? I have no reason to trust you any more than you trust me."
"And here I thought we were such pals," I said.
"Well, we're not," he said mildly.
I eased the key out of my pocket and held it up to the light. "You know anything about this?" His gaze flicked to the key.
"Where'd you get that?"
"It was in a safe Bucky found in Johnny's apartment." "Have you ever seen it before?"
"No."
"What about the safe? Did you know about that?" He shook his head slowly. This was like pulling teeth. "I don't understand what the deal is," I said.
"There's no deal. It's nothing."
"If it's nothing, why not tell? It can't do any harm."
"Look, I might know who busted in. If it's who I think, then some guy might have followed me out here. That's all it is, and I could be wrong about that."
"What was he after?"
"Geez, don't you ever give up?"
"You must have some idea."
"Well, I don't."
"Of course you do," I said. "Why else would you drive all the way out here from Ashland?"
Agitated, he got up and crossed to the window, shoving his hands in his pockets.
"Hey, come on. Enough. I'm getting tired of this. You can't force me to answer, so you might as well lay off."
I got up and followed him to the window, leaning against the wall so I could watch his face.
Here's the way my mind works.
This sounds like something criminal. I tapped my temple. I'm thinking to myself, what if Johnny never went into the Air Force? I keep having trouble with that piece of it. If he wasn't in the service, then the whole picture shifts, because then you have to wonder where he was all that time. Ray's gaze met mine. He started to say something, but he seemed to think better of it. Want to hear my theory? I just came up with this, I said. He might have been in prison. Maybe this business about the Air Force, this AVG bullshit, was just a polite explanation for his absence. The war had started by then. It sounds a lot more patriotic to say your husband's gone overseas than he's been sent up. I waited a moment, but Ray made no response. I cupped a hand behind my ear. Care to comment? He shook his head. It's your theory. You can think anything you want. You're not going to help me out? Not a bit, he said. I pushed away from the wall. Well, maybe you'll change your mind. I live around the corner from Johnny's, 5 doors down on Albanil. You can stop by and chat when you're ready. I moved toward the door. I don't get this, he said. I mean, what's it to you? I looked back at him. I have a hunch, and I'd like to find out if I'm right. In my line of work, it's good practice. For lunch, I treated myself to a quarter pounder with cheese, and then spent the afternoon curled up with the new Elmore Leonard novel. I'd been telling myself how much fun it was having nothing to do, but I noticed that I was faintly disconcerted by the idleness. Generally, I don't think of myself as compulsive, but I don't like wasting time. I tidied my apartment and cleaned out some drawers, went back to my book and tried to concentrate. Late in the afternoon, I shrugged into my blazer and walked up to the corner for a bite to eat. I was thinking about an early movie if I could figure out what to see. The neighborhood was quiet, half the front porches picked out in light. There was a chill in the air, and the dark seemed to be coming down earlier and earlier. I could smell somebody's supper cooking, and the images were cozy. Once in a while, I find myself at loose ends, and that's when I feel the lack of a relationship. There's something about love that brings a sense of focus to life. I wouldn't complain about the sex, either, if I could remember how it went. I'd have to get out the instructor's manual if I ever managed to get laid again. Rosie's was nearly empty, but shortly after I sat down, I spotted Babe and Bucky coming through the door. I waved, and the two of them approached my back booth, walking hip to hip, their arms wound around each other's waists. I said, "Where's your dad, Bucky? I've been hoping to run into him. We need to talk." "He took a load over to the dump, but he should be back shortly," Bucky said. "You want to join us? We thought we'd sit at the bar and watch the 6 o'clock news until Dad gets here." In the half-light of the tavern, he was looking nearly handsome. Babe was in boots, a long jean skirt, and a blue jeans jacket. "Thanks, but I may try to eat quick and catch an early movie." "Well, we'll be over there if you should change your mind." They sauntered off to the bar. Meanwhile, Rosie appeared from the kitchen, and I watched her draw 2 beers before she came over to me. She had already pulled out her pencil and order pad and was scribbling away. "I got perfect dish for you," she said as she snatched my dinner menu. "It slices pork liver with sausage and garlic pickles, cooked with bacon. Also, I'm making you apple and Savoy cabbage salad with crackling biscuits." "Sounds inspired," I said. I didn't say by what. "You're gonna have this with beer. It's better than wine, which don't mix good with garlic pickles." "I should say not." I ate, I must say, with a hearty appetite, though I'd probably have indigestion later. The place was beginning to fill up with happy hour crowd people from the neighborhood and singles getting off work. Rosie's had become a favorite hangout among the local sporting set, thus ruining it for those of us in search of peace and quiet. If it weren't for my fondness for Rosie and the close proximity to my apartment, I might have moved on to some new eatery. I saw Bucky and Babe move over to a table. Chester came in moments later, and the three conferred before ordering supper. By then the place was so noisy that it didn't seem tactful to join them and launch into talk about Johnny's past history. At 6:35, I paid my check and headed out the front door. I was already losing interest in the movie, but there was always a chance I could generate enthusiasm from the sibs. When I got home, I crossed the back patio and knocked at the frame. I heard a muffled, "Yoo-hoo!" I peered in through the screen and spotted Nell sitting in a wooden kitchen chair pulled up close to the stove. She was peering in my direction, and when she saw me, she motioned me in. I opened the door and stuck my head in. "Hi, Nell. How are you?" The stove had been dismantled. The oven door open, oven racks removed, apparently in preparation for a thorough cleaning. The counter was lined with newspaper on which the oven racks were laid, still seething with oven cleaner. "Fine and dandy. Come on in, Kinsey. It's good to see you." Ordinarily, she wore her thick silver hair pulled back in an elaborate arrangement of tortoiseshell combs. But today she'd tied her hair into the folds of a scarf, which made her look like an ancient Cinderella. "You're industrious," I said. "You just got here and already you're hard at work." "Well, I'm not happy until I can take a stove apart and really clean in there good. Henry's extremely able when it comes to household chores, but a stove is the sort of thing needs a woman's touch. I know that sounds sexist, but it's the truth," she said. "You need help?" "I could sure use the company." Nell was wearing a pinafore-style apron over her cotton house dress, her long sleeves protected by cuffs of paper toweling that she'd secured with rubber bands. She was a big woman, probably close to 6 feet tall in her prime. Wide-shouldered, heavy-breasted, she had good-sized feet and hands, though her knuckles were now as knotted as ropes beneath the skin. Her face was long and bony, nearly sexless in its character. Sparse white brows, electric blue eyes, her skin vertically draped with seams and folds. All the shelves had been emptied from the refrigerator, the countertops crowded with leftovers and covered bowls, olive and pickle jars, condiments, raw vegetables. The storage drawers had been removed, and one was sitting in a sink full of soapy water. She'd tossed a number of items in the kitchen wastebasket, and I could see that she'd dumped something gloppy in the disposal. "Don't look at that. I think it's still alive," she said. She was wringing out the cloth she was using to wipe down the shelves. "Once I finish this, I intend to take a bubble bath, and then I'll get into my robe and slippers. I have some reading to catch up on. I keep thinking any day now my eyes are going out on me, and I want to get in as much as possible." She had unscrewed a jar lid and was peering in. She sniffed, unable to identify the contents. "What in heaven's name is this?" She held it up to the light. The liquid was bright red and syrupy. "I think it's the glaze for the cherry tart Henry makes. You know, he cleaned the refrigerator just 2 days ago." She screwed the lid back on and put the jar on the counter. "That's what he said. As it happens, cleaning refrigerators is one of my specialties. I taught Henry how to do it back in 1912. His problem is he isn't sufficiently rigorous. Most of us aren't when it comes to our own trash. As long as I'm here, I might as well get everything shipshape." "Was that your lot in life, teaching all the boys how to do things around the house?" "More or less. I helped Mother raise and educate all 10 of us at home. After Father died, I felt obliged to stay on until she recovered her spirits, which took close to 30 years. She was heartsick when she lost him, though as I recollect, the two of them never got along that well. My, my. How she did grieve for the man. It occurred to me later she was putting on a bit just to keep me underfoot." 10 kids? I thought there were only 5. You, Charlie, Lewis, William, and Henry." She shook her head. "We were the 5 surviving children. We took after the Tillmans on our mother's side. In our family, there was a distinct division among the children she bore. Half took after her side of the family, and the other half took after the Pitts on Father's side. Line us up for a photograph, and you could see it plain as day. Now, this is a fact. All Father's people up and died. It was a pitiful genetic line when you stop and calculate. They were small people with tiny heads, so they didn't have the brains our side of the family did,
and they had no physical stamina whatsoever. Our father's mother was a Moritz by birth. The name translates as Moorish, which suggests a bunch of blackamoors somewhere up the line. They were swarthy, all of them, and just as feeble as could be. Our grandmother Moritz died of the influenza, and so did two brothers above me. It was a mess. She went, and he went, and the other one went. Our sister Alice was another one we lost. Dark-skinned, tiny head, she died of the influenza within a day of taking sick. Four cousins, an aunt. Sometimes two would go on the same day, and we'd have a double funeral. That entire line was wiped out in a 5-month period between November and March. Those of us who took after Mother are the only ones left, and we expect to go on for years. Mother lived to be 103. Right about the time she turned 90, she got so crabby we threatened to withhold her sour mash whiskey if she didn't straighten up. She only required 6 tablespoons a day, but she believed it was absolutely essential to life. We put the bottle right up on the shelf where she could see it, but couldn't reach. That settled her right down, and she went on for another 13 years just as gentle as a lamb. She closed the refrigerator door temporarily and returned to the sink, where the dishwater was now cool enough to allow her to wash the meat bin. She opened the cabinet under the sink, and I saw a frown cross her face. "What's the matter?" "Henry's out of the oven cleaner I like to use on these racks." She peered in the cabinet again. "Well, I'll just have to use a little elbow grease." "You want me to make a quick run to the market? I can pick some up. It won't take 10 minutes.
"No, that's all right. I can always use a scrub pad.
It'll clean up in a jiffy. You have other things to do."
"I don't mind a bit. I was thinking about a movie, but I've lost interest, to tell the truth."
"Are you sure you don't mind?"
"Scout's honor," I said.
"I'd surely appreciate it. We're low on milk, too. Once the kids have their milk and cookies tonight, there won't be enough for breakfast. This is really awfully sweet."
"Don't even think about it. I'll be back shortly. What kind of milk? Low fat?"
"Half a gallon of skim. I'm trying to wean the kids off fat where I can."
I searched through my handbag for the car keys and then eased the strap across my shoulder as I headed out the door. My car was parked about 2 doors down. I fired up the ignition and pulled away from the curb. At the corner of Albanil and Bay, I turned right, passing Bucky's place, which had become my new reference point in the neighborhood. I'd probably never pass the house again without turning to look. I peered down the drive toward the garage apartment. Lights were on upstairs, and I saw a shadow move across the front windows. I slowed to a stop, peering up at the apartment. I didn't think any of the Lees were home. The last I'd seen, the three of them were still up at Rosie's having supper. The lights went out, and I saw someone emerge onto the darkened landing. Well, this was interesting. I spotted a parking place and pulled in at the curb. I turned the engine off and doused my headlights. I adjusted the rearview mirror so that it was angled on the drive, and then slid down in the seat. A man moved out of the driveway with a hefty-looking duffel bag in his right hand. He was walking in my direction, his head down, his shoulders hunched. From the dim glow of the street lamp, I could see it wasn't Bucky, Chester, or Ray. This guy had a full head of dark, curly hair. His clothing was dark, and he must have been wearing rubber-soled shoes, because his footsteps made hardly any sound on the pavement as he passed. He set off across the street. I kept him in sight, watching with curiosity as he approached a white Ford Taurus, parked at the far curb, facing the opposite direction. He shifted the duffel to his left hand while he took out his car keys and unlocked the door on the driver's side. Puzzled, I glanced back toward Bucky's, but the premises were still dark and there were no signs of life. The man opened the door and shoved the duffel toward the passenger seat, slid in behind the wheel, and slammed the car door shut. I watched as he checked his reflection in the rearview mirror, smoothed his hair back, and settled a Stetson on his head. I eased out of sight while he started his ignition, flipped the lights on, and took off, his headlights raking my windshield. As soon as he turned the corner, I started my car and pulled away from the curb. I did a quick U-turn, yanked on my headlights, and took the corner maybe 6 seconds after he had. I caught a glimpse of his taillights as he turned right on Castle. I had to floor it to maintain visual contact. Within minutes, he turned onto the northbound freeway off-ramp, heading toward Colgate. I eased into the line of traffic two cars behind him and kept my foot firmly pressed to the accelerator.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 6. A one-car surveillance is usually a waste of time, especially at night, where a second set of headlights becomes conspicuous in a subject's rear-view mirror. In this case, whatever this guy was up to, I didn't think he had any idea I was following. Coming out of Johnny's garage apartment, he'd seemed neither watchful nor cautious, and I had to believe a tail was the last thing he expected. I hadn't expected it myself, so I was at least as surprised as he was. He did nothing on the freeway. No tricky lane changes, no sudden exits, to indicate that he was aware of my presence. The Stetson, in silhouette, gave me a nice visual cue against the wash of approaching headlights. He took the off-ramp at Upper State Street, and I slid into the lane behind him. While I steered with my left hand, I scrounged around in my handbag for a scrap of paper and a pen. At least I could take his license plate number while I had him in range. The nature of the plate number indicated that the car was a rental, a further clue being the penny car rental on the license plate rim. Big duh. I made a note of the number on the back of an old grocery list. Later I'd find someone to check the rental car records. It was 7:17 by the time the white Taurus pulled into the gravel courtyard of the Capri, a 10-unit motor hotel off the frontage road. The perimeter of the parking area was delineated by a drooping strand of Christmas tree lights that had been strung from pole to pole. The motel itself was made up of two rows of small frame and clapboard cottages, each with a carport affixed to one side. The darkness had draped the exteriors in sufficient shadow to conceal the flaking paint, warping window screens, and poor construction. Most of the cottages appeared to be empty. Windows unlighted, no vehicles in the carports. A pint-sized U-Haul truck was parked in front of one unit. The first two cottages on the left were occupied, along with the second unit on the right, which was where the Taurus was now parked. The driver locked his vehicle and moved up to the cottage's small concrete porch, with its light offering 40 watts worth of illumination. I waited until he'd unlocked the cottage and entered before I eased my VW along the gravel parking lot to a darkened unit across the way. I backed into the carport, doused my headlights, and rolled the window down. The stillness was punctuated by the ticking of my engine as the metal cooled. Also by a failing green Christmas tree bulb that flickered and buzzed somewhere above my head like a jolly green bee. I sat in the dark, pondering how long I'd be willing to wait before I headed home. Poor Nell must be wondering how far away the supermarket was. I'd promised her a quick trip, 15 minutes max. I'd now been gone twice that long. I had a squirrely feeling in the pit of my stomach, a strange emotional concoction of anxiety and excitement. What was in the duffel the guy had taken off the premises? Could be burglar's tools. I was operating on the assumption that this was the same guy who tossed the place before, though I couldn't imagine what was worth coming back for. Ray Rawson had some suspicions about who the break-in artist might have been, but he'd given no indication why anyone would bother. I wished now I'd pressed him for the information. Meanwhile, it was worth a short wait. If I ran out of patience, I'd make a note of the motel address and use a phone ruse in the morning to find out who was staying there. I checked my watch again. It was now 7:32. The fellow had been in there 15 minutes or so. Was he in for the night? I really couldn't sit here indefinitely, and I didn't think it made sense to go prowling around the cottage trying to peer in the windows. The guy might be traveling with a bad-tempered mutt that would set up a stink. This was the kind of place that would have to accommodate kids and weird pets. How else would they get business except by accident? Just about the time I was ready to pack it in, I saw some movement on the cottage porch. The man emerged accompanied by a woman, who now carried the duffel bag. He still wore his hat, and he was toting a suitcase, which he stowed in the trunk.
She handed him the duffel, and he tucked it in with the suitcase. He opened the car door, giving her an assist as she got into the seat on the passenger side. I noticed they didn't bother with any checkout procedure. Either they were only leaving for a short time, or they were decamping without paying. He went around to the driver's side. I started my engine at the same time he started his, using his noise as a cover for mine. His taillights came on, the two bright red spots overlaid with the white of his backup lights. I left my headlights off, waiting until the Taurus backed out and made a right turn into the street. The Taurus took off toward the highway, and I followed at a discreet distance. I wasn't happy with the arrangement. There wasn't much other traffic on the road, and if I had to tail the guy for long, I was going to get burned. Fortunately, he headed for the northbound freeway on-ramp, and by the time I eased in behind him, there were sufficient cars on the road to camouflage my presence. The driver of the Taurus stayed in the right lane and proceeded for two off-ramps before he finally took the exit designated for the airport and the university. With two bags in the trunk, I didn't think they were on their way to a UCST night class. The ramp curved up and around to the left, widening into six lanes. A yellow cab merged with us from an access road, and I eased back on the accelerator, allowing the taxi to slip in between us. The Taurus stayed in the right lane and turned off at Rock Pit, turning right again at the stop sign. I stayed in the slipstream as first the Taurus and then the taxi turned in at the airport. I watched as the Taurus moved into the left lane and slowed at the ticket meter for the short-term parking lot. The ticket arm went up like an automated salute. Meanwhile, the taxi kept to the right, pulling up at the curb in the passenger loading zone, where two passengers got out with their luggage. I waited until the Taurus drove into the short-term lot before I eased the VW forward. The ticket dispenser buzzed, and a parking ticket emerged from the slot like a tongue. I snagged it and rolled forward into the lot. The Taurus had turned into the first aisle on the left and was now parked in the front row, close to the road. I caught a quick glimpse of the couple as they crossed toward the terminal. He carried both the suitcase and the duffel. She was wearing a raincoat pulled around her for warmth. I scanned the spaces available and pulled into the first empty spot. I parked, locked up, and dog-trotted after them. The two were engaged in conversation, and neither seemed aware of my company. It was fully dark by now, the terminal building lighted up like one of those miniature cottages you put under the Christmas tree. There were two skycaps at the curb, putting tags on the suitcases of the two travelers the taxi had disgorged. The couple went into the terminal. I noticed they were bypassing the car rental offices. Were they skipping? I doubled my pace, my shoulder bag banging against one hip, as I jogged down the short walk to the entrance. The terminal at the Santa Teresa Airport has only six working gates. In the left wing, gates 1, 2, and 3 serviced commuter airlines. The puddle jumpers doing short runs to and from Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Jose, Fresno, Sacramento, and other points within about a 400-mile radius. In the main lobby, United Airlines was sharing counter space with American. I did a quick visual survey, checking out the passengers seated in various groupings of linked upholstered chairs. The Stetson should have made the guy fairly easy to spot, but there was no sign of the pair. Most departing passengers were processed through Gate 5, which was plainly visible across the small lobby. At this hour of the night, air traffic wasn't heavy, and a check of the departures monitor indicated only two outbound flights. One was a United prop jet to Los Angeles, the other an American Airlines flight to Palm Beach, with an intervening stop at Dallas-Fort Worth. Dead ahead was Gate 4, which was used as the arrival gate for United's incoming flights. Arched windows looked out onto a small grassy area, defined by outdoor lights and surrounded by a stucco wall, topped with a 3-foot rim of protective window glass. I could hear the high-pitched drone of a small plane approaching along the runway. I moved to the double doors and checked the courtyard. There were maybe 6 or 8 people scattered across the area, a woman with a toddler, 3 college students, an older couple with a dog on a leash. No sign of the couple I was looking for. As I passed through the main lobby toward the commuter wing, I spotted the Stetson, black felt with a broad brim and a high soft crown. The guy was in the gift shop paying for a couple of magazines. I was catching him in profile, but the light was excellent. As if obliging me, he took off his hat and ruffled his hair before he readjusted the angle of the hat on his head. I studied him with care so that I could identify him again if it ever came to that. I put him in his late 50s, with small, dark eyes, in a lean, hawkish face. He had a bushy salt-and-pepper mustache. What by streetlight had appeared to be dark, curly hair, I could now see was heavily interwoven with strands of silver. He wore cowboy boots, jeans, and a heavy dark wool jacket. I pegged him at 6 feet, though the boots might have added inches, maybe 160 to 175 pounds. He tucked the magazines under his arm and crammed the change in his pocket. I backed away from the door as he turned in my direction. Behind me was a bank of public telephones. In part as cover and in part out of desperation, I turned to the first phone and hauled up the phone book that was chained to the metal shelf below. I busied myself looking up Bucky's number while the guy came out of the gift shop behind me. Obliquely, I watched as he crossed the lobby, joined the woman who was now standing at the ticket counter with her back to me, the duffel at her feet. Where had she come from? Probably the ladies' room. The line she was standing in was designated for the purchasing of tickets. She'd taken off her raincoat, which was now folded across one arm. The passenger in front of her finished his business, and she moved to the counter, placing a big, soft-sided suitcase on the weighing apparatus. She reached back with one foot, shifting the duffel forward until it rested against the counter beside her. The ticket agent greeted her, and the two exchanged a few words. While the agent tapped on her computer keyboard, the woman reached over and picked up a cardboard identification strip from a container on the counter. She filled in the details, and then gave the tag to the ticket agent, who was just in the process of assembling the ticket. The woman laid out a sheaf of bills, which the ticket agent counted and then put away. She secured the woman's identification to the suitcase, along with a claim tag, and then placed the suitcase on the conveyor belt. The moving bag was spirited through a small opening like a coffin on its way to the flames. The two finished their transaction, and the agent passed the woman's ticket envelope across the counter to her. When the woman turned to her companion, I could see that she was 6 or 7 months pregnant. Was this his daughter? She was much younger than the fellow who accompanied her. Early to mid-30s, gaudy auburn hair piled in a tangled knot on top. Her complexion had the pasty look of too much foundation, overlaid with a shade of powder that made her face seem faintly dirty. Her maternity outfit was one of those oversized pale blue denim dresses with short sleeves and a dropped waist, against which her belly bulged. Under the dress, she wore an oversized white T-shirt with long sleeves. She also wore red and white striped tights and high-topped red tennis shoes. The dress itself I'd seen in a gardening catalog, a style favored by former hippies who'd given up dope and communal sex for organic vegetables and all-natural fiber clothes. The guy picked up the duffel, and the two moved aside as the next passenger in line moved up to the counter. He put the duffel down again, and they stood to one side, engaged in desultory conversation. These people were about to get on a plane, and what was I supposed to do? A citizen's arrest seemed like dicey business at best. I couldn't even swear that a crime had been committed. On the other hand, what else was this guy doing up in Johnny Lee's apartment? I'd been a cop just long enough to have a nose for these things. To all appearances, the duffel bag was about to be transported out of state. I had no idea if the pair intended to return to Santa Teresa or were engaged in unlawful flight. I turned back to the phone book and flipped through the pages with agitation, talking to myself. Come on, come on, Lawrence, Lehman. I ran a finger down the columns. Leeson, Leatherman, Lieber. 15 listings under Lee, but only one on Bay. Bucyrus Lee. Bucky's name was Bucyrus? I found a quarter in my blazer pocket, dropped it in the slot, and dialed the number. The receiver was picked up on the second ring. Hello, Bucky?
This is Chester. Who's this?
Kinsey.
Shit, you better get over here. All hell's broken loose.
What's going on?
We came home from Rosie's to find Ray Rawson crawling down the drive, face all bloody, hands swole up the size of a baseball mitt. He's got 2 fingers snapped sideways and God knows what else. Somebody busted in again and ripped into the space under the kitchen cabinet.
Over the intercom system, an announcement was being made about an American Airlines flight.
Hang on a second, I said. I put my hand across the mouthpiece. I'd missed the specifics, but it had to be the boarding call for the flight to Palm Beach. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the guy pick up the duffel, and together he and the pregnant woman moved out of the terminal, turning left toward the American Airlines departure gate. I could feel my heart pound. I turned my attention back to Chester. Is Rawson okay?
Hey, we got cop cars all over and an ambulance on the way. He don't look so good. What's all the racket? I can hardly hear you.
That's why I called. I'm at the airport, I said. I saw a guy coming out of the apartment with a duffel. It looks like he and some woman are about to get on a plane. I tailed him this far, but once we lose track of that bag, it's only my word against his.
Hang on. I'll grab Bucky and head out. Just don't let go of him until we get there.
Chester, the plane's boarding. Do you know what he took?
I have no idea. I can't even get in until the place clears out. What about airport security? Can't they give you a hand?
What airport security? There's not an officer in sight. I'm here by myself.
Well, for God's sake, do something.
I flashed through the possibilities. Authorize a ticket and I'll follow him, I said.
To where?
The plane's on its way to Palm Beach with a stop in Dallas. Make up your mind because 2 minutes more and he's out of here.
Do it. We'll settle later. Call me when you can.
I banged the receiver down and checked the departures monitor again in passing. Beside the posted departure time for American Flight 508, the word boarding was blinking merrily. The terminal had emptied of waiting passengers, who were apparently assembling at the gate. I trotted across the lobby to the American Airlines ticket counter. One of the two agents was busy with a passenger, but the other caught my eye.
I can help you over here.
I moved to her station. Are there any seats available on the flight to Palm Beach? I had no idea if the couple were on their way to Dallas or Palm Beach, but I had to assume the latter if I intended to stick with them.
Let me see what we have. I know the flight's not full.
She began to type rapidly on the computer keyboard in front of her, pausing while her eye took in the data appearing on the screen in front of her.
We have 17 seats, 12 in coach and 5 in first class.
What's coach fare?
$487.
That wasn't bad. And that's round trip?
One way.
$487 one way? My voice squeaked like I had just that minute reached puberty.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll take it, I said. You better leave the return open-ended. I'm not sure how long I'll be staying. The truth was, I had no idea where the couple was headed. Their real destination could be Mexico, South America, or just about anywhere. I hadn't seen any sign of passports changing hands, but I couldn't rule out the possibility. Since this wasn't the same agent who dealt with the pregnant woman, there wasn't any point in quizzing her. I pulled out my wallet and took out a credit card, which I placed on the counter. She didn't seem to question the wisdom of the impulse. Oh, man. Chester had better pay up or I was sunk.
Would you prefer an aisle seat or a window?
Aisle, near the front. For all I knew, the couple would be first off the plane. I wanted to be ready to cut and run when they did. She typed another entry, tapping away in a leisurely manner.
You have bags to check?
Just carry on, I said. I wanted to scream at her to hurry, but there wasn't any point. The ticket machine began to rattle and hum, generating my ticket, the boarding pass, and the credit card voucher, which I signed where specified. I could feel my eyes cross slightly when I saw what I'd paid. The round-trip coach fare, without benefit of upgrade certificates or advance purchase discounts, had cost me $974. I did some quick arithmetic. The limit on this credit card was $2,500, and I was still paying off some purchases I'd made over the summer. By my calculations, I had about $400 left. Oh, well, it wasn't like I didn't have money in my savings account. I just couldn't get to it at this hour of the night. I took my ticket envelope, thanked the agent, and scurried out the front of the terminal and around to Gate 6, where I placed my handbag on the conveyor moving through the X-ray machine. I removed Johnny's key from my jeans pocket and tucked it in my handbag. I walked through the metal detector without incident and reclaimed my handbag on the other side. First-class passengers and parents with small children had already passed through the gate and had left the terminal. I could see them straggling across the tarmac toward the waiting plane. General boarding was now underway, and I took my place at the rear of the slow-moving line. The man in the Stetson was clearly visible. About 6 passengers ahead of me, the couple stood together, saying little or nothing. She now carried the magazines, and he toted the duffel. Their behavior with each other seemed strained,
their faces devoid of animation. I saw no evidence of affection except for the belly, which suggested at least one round of intimacy 6 or 7 months back. Maybe they'd been forced to get married because of the baby. Whatever the explanation, the emotional dynamic between them seemed dead. When they reached the gate, the guy handed her the duffel and said something. She murmured her response without looking at him. She seemed withdrawn, decidedly chilly in her reaction to him. He put an arm around her shoulder and gave her cheek a kiss. He stepped back then and tucked his hands in his pockets, looking on while she handed her boarding pass to the gate agent and walked out with the duffel in her hand. Uh-oh, now what? He waited by the gate until she'd moved out of sight. I hesitated, considering my options. I could always follow him, but the duffel was the point, at least until I found out what was in it. Once the booty was gone, how was anyone going to trace it back to the source? The guy turned in my direction, heading for the exit. He caught my eye briefly before I could avert my gaze. I flicked another look at him and snapped a mental photograph of his grizzled face, the scar on his chin, a deeply indented line of white that began with his lower lip and continued down along his neck. He'd either gone through a window or had his face slashed. The gate agent took my proffered ticket, handing back the torn stub from my boarding pass. If I was going to bail out, now was the time to do it. Ahead of me, across the poorly lighted expanse of asphalt, I saw the pregnant woman reach the top of the portable staircase and pass through the door of the plane. I took a deep breath and walked out onto the tarmac, where I crossed the open space to the stairs. The air was brisk, and the perpetual wind that seems to whip along the runway cut through the fabric of my tweed blazer. I climbed the portable stairs, shoes tinking on the metal treads as I ascended. I was happier once I'd crossed the threshold of the 737 into the lighted warmth of the interior. I glanced at the 3 first-class passengers, but the pregnant woman wasn't among them. I checked the seat number on the stub of my boarding pass. 10D. Probably over the wing and on the left side of the plane. While I waited for the passengers ahead of me to stow carry-on bags and settle in their seats, I managed to skim my gaze across the first few rows of coach. She was sitting 8 rows back in a window seat on the right. She'd taken out a compact and was peering into the mirror. She took out a bottle of makeup, opened it, and dotted beige across her cheeks, blending it in. At eye level, most of the luggage bins above the seats were standing open. I moved forward, waiting for the college student ahead of me to shove a canvas bag the size of an ottoman in the overhead compartment. As I passed row 8, I saw the duffel, half concealed by the pregnant woman's folded raincoat, both items shoved in between a bulging canvas garment bag, a briefcase, and a luggage cart. The very items destined to tumble out and bonk you on the head on landing. If I'd had the nerve, I'd have simply picked up the duffel and toted it with me, shoving it under my seat until I had a moment to search the contents. The pregnant woman glanced in my direction. I turned away from her casually. I took my seat and tucked my shoulder bag under the seat in front of me. The 2 seats next to me were empty, and I sent up small airline-type prayers that I'd have the row to myself. In a pinch, I could flip the arms up and stretch out for a nap. The pregnant woman got up just then and stepped out into the aisle, where she reached up into the overhead bin. She pushed the garment bag aside and wrestled a hardback book from an outer pocket of the duffel. The girl's steward person moved down the aisle behind her, snapping the overhead bins shut with a series of small bangs. Shortly after the doors closed, the girl's steward person stood up in front of the assembled company and gave detailed instructions, with a practical demonstration, on how to fasten and unfasten our seatbelts. I wondered if there was anybody present still befuddled by this. She also explained what to do if we were on the verge of being smashed, crushed, and burned by hurtling at high velocity from our flying altitude of 26,000 feet straight down through the Earth's crust. To me, the little hang-down oxygen bag seemed irrelevant, but it apparently made her feel better to pass along tips about the application of this device. To distract us from the possibility of death en route, she promised us a drink cart and a snack once we were airborne. The plane rolled away from the terminal and taxied out onto the runway. There was a pause, and then the plane began to surge forward, picking up speed with much earnest intent. We rumbled and bumbled like the little engine that could. The plane lifted off into the night sky, the lighted buildings below becoming rapidly smaller, until only a hapless grid of lights remained. Chapter 7. I checked the seat pocket in front of me. Barf bags, laminated card with cartoon safety procedures, boring airline magazine, and a gift catalog in case I wanted to do my mid-air Christmas shopping. This was going to be a long trip, and me without my trusty Leonard novel. I felt my gaze return to the pregnant woman, who was seated across the aisle and two rows forward. At this remove, I could only see a portion of her face. The tangle of auburn hair made me long to have at her with a brush. I still couldn't believe I was doing this. I decided I'd better do a quick inventory to assess my situation. I had the clothes on my back, which consisted of my Reeboks and socks, underwear, jeans, turtleneck, and blazer. I put my hands in my blazer pockets and came up with last week's movie receipt, 2 quarters, and a ballpoint pen, plus a paperclip. I felt my right-hand jeans pocket, which was empty. In the other pocket, I had a wadded-up tissue, which I pulled out and used to blow my nose. One by one, I removed the items from my handbag and laid them on the seat beside me. I had my wallet with my California driver's license and my PI license, 2 major credit cards, one of which was good for $2,500, less the current balance, of course, the other of which I now noticed had expired. Well, damn. I had $46.52 in cash, my telephone charge card, and an ATM card which would be useless outside California. Where was my checkbook? Ah, sitting at home on my desk where I'd been paying bills. Virtue is pointless in a crunch, as it turns out. If I'd neglected my debts, I'd have my checkbook with me, extending my tangible assets by $300 or $400. Tucked in the inner compartment of my wallet, I had my key picks, always a handy item for the impromptu jet-setter. Additionally, I had the toothbrush and toothpaste and the clean pair of underpants I always carry with me. I also had my Swiss Army knife, my sunglasses, a comb, a lipstick, a corkscrew, the key from Johnny's safe, 2 pens, the used grocery list on which I'd made a note of the Taurus's license plate number, a small bottle of aspirin, and my birth control pills. Whatever else happened, I wasn't going to get pregnant, so why fret? I was, after all, on vacation, and I had no other pressing responsibilities. I didn't have the faintest idea what I'd do once we landed. Obviously, I'd wait and see what course of action my traveling companion elected. If she was leaving the country, there was nothing I could do about it, as the one thing I didn't have in my possession was my passport. I could probably travel into Mexico using my driver's license, but I didn't like to do that. I'd heard too many stories about Mexican jails. On the plus side, my return ticket was paid for, so I could always get straight back on a plane and come home. In the meantime, the worst that could happen was I'd make a fool of myself. Not exactly unprecedented in my experience. As soon as the seatbelt sign went off, I unbuckled myself and searched through the overhead bin for a pillow and a blanket. I moved to the back of the plane and utilized the in-flight plumbing, washed my hands, checked my reflection in the lavatory mirror, and picked up a copy of Time magazine as I returned to my seat. The pilot came on the intercom and said some piloty things in a reassuring tone. He told us about our flying altitude, the weather, and the flight course, along with our estimated time of arrival. The drink cart came by, and I treated myself to $3 worth of bad wine. I could hardly wait to eat my $487 snack, which turned out to be a cherry tomato, a sprig of parsley, and a deli bun the size of a paperweight. Dessert was a foil-wrapped chocolate wafer. Once we'd been fed, the cabin lights went down. Half the passengers opted for sleep, while the other half flipped on their reading lights and either read or did paperwork. 45 minutes passed, and I noticed the pregnant woman walking past my seat. I turned and watched with interest as she headed toward the 2 lavatories at the rear of the plane. I scanned the other passengers in the immediate vicinity. Most were asleep. No one seemed to be paying any attention to me. The minute the woman closed herself into the toilet, I eased out of my seat and moved 2 rows forward, where I sat down in the aisle seat 2 over from hers. I made a brief display of checking the seat pocket, as if searching out some pertinent item therein. I wasn't going to have the time or the audacity to take down the duffel. The woman had apparently taken her handbag with her. Not very trusting of her, so I couldn't riffle the contents. I checked her seat pocket. Nothing of interest in there. All she'd left behind was the hardback Danielle Steele novel, closed now and lying in the middle seat. I checked the inside cover, but there was no name written in the book. I noticed she was using her boarding pass as a bookmark. I plucked it out, slid the stub in my blazer pocket, and returned to my seat. No one shrieked or pointed or denounced me on sight. Moments later, the pregnant woman passed me again, returning to her seat. I saw her pick up her book. She rose halfway and checked the seat cushion under her, then leaned down and searched in the area around her seat for the missing boarding pass. I could almost see the question mark appear, cloud-like, in the air above her head. She seemed to shrug. She got up again and took a pillow and weensy blanket from the overhead bin, flipped the light out, and settled down in her seat with the blanket across her chest. I eased the stub of her boarding pass from my blazer pocket and took in the minimal information printed on it. Her name was Laura Huckabee. Her destination, Palm Beach. Dallas-Fort Worth was in the Central Time Zone, 2 hours ahead of us. After 3+ hours in the air, it was 1:45 in the morning by the time we finally landed. A few minutes prior to our arrival, the flight attendant came on the intercom with the gate numbers for various connecting flights. She also advised us that the plane would be on the ground for approximately 1 hour and 10 minutes before the continuation of Flight 508 to Palm Beach. If we intended to deplane, we'd need to have our boarding passes with us for reboarding purposes. Poor Laura Huckabee was now minus her boarding pass, thanks to my chicanery. I watched her with guilt, expecting her to engage in an anxious conversation with the girl steward person, or else remain unhappily in her seat until her flight took off again. Instead, once we were parked at the gate and the seatbelt sign was turned off, she got up, retrieved her raincoat and the duffel, tucked the book in the outer pocket, and joined the slowly moving line of departing passengers. I didn't know what to make of this, but I was compelled to follow. We stumped along the jetway in haphazard fashion, an irregular assortment of exhausted late-night travelers. The few passengers with carry-on bags gravitated toward the exits, but mostly people headed toward the baggage claim area. I kept Laura Huckabee well within my sights. Her auburn hair had been flattened in sleep, and the back of her jumper was pleated with horizontal wrinkles. She still had the raincoat draped over one arm, but she had to pause twice to switch the duffel from hand to hand. Where was she going? Did she think this was Palm Beach? The Dallas-Fort Worth Airport was done in neutrals and beiges, the floor tiles clay-colored. The corridors were wide and quiet at that hour of the morning. A group of Asian businessmen was driven past us in a whirring electric cart, a repetitious tone peeping to warn unwary pedestrians. The overhead lighting made us all look jaundiced. Most concession kiosks were gated and dark. We passed a restaurant and a combination news and gift shop selling hard and paperback books, glossy magazines, newspapers, Texas barbecue sauces, Tex-Mex cookbooks, and T-shirts with Texas logos. The baggage claim area for Flight 508 appeared ahead of us beyond a revolving door. Laura Huckabee pushed through ahead of me and then hesitated on the far side as if to get her bearings. I thought at first she might be looking for someone, but that didn't seem to be the case. I moved past her and crossed to the carousel where the bags would be coming in. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Had she always intended to deplane at this point? Was her suitcase checked all the way through to Palm Beach, or only as far as Dallas-Fort Worth? A row of linked chrome and faux leather chairs was arranged to the left. A television set had been mounted up on the wall in one corner, and most of the heads were tilted in that direction. Pictured in garish color was the wreckage of a recent plane crash, black smoke still rising from the charred fuselage in a harshly lighted landscape. The reporter spoke directly to the camera. She wore a camel hair overcoat, snow billowing around her. The wind whipped her hair and stung her cheeks with hot pink. The sound was barely audible, but none of us had any doubts about the subject matter. I crossed to the water fountain and took a long, noisy drink. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Laura Huckabee approach the wall-mounted directory, where she studied a set of printed instructions about how to call the shuttle service for the numerous hotels in the vicinity. She picked up the phone receiver and punched in four numbers. A brief conversation followed. I waited until she'd hung up again, and then I intersected her path, falling in behind her as she approached the escalator. We descended to street level, where we proceeded through a set of plate glass doors. Outside, the night air was surprisingly cold. Despite the artificial lighting, a pervasive gloom blanketed the pickup area. Landscaping had been tucked in between the sidewalk and the building. Along the buff-colored facade, the grass was planted in tufts at distinctly placed intervals, like the plugs on a hair transplant. I proceeded to the area marked courtesy shuttles, where I turned and waited, peering patiently along the roadway. Laura Huckabee and I made no eye contact. She seemed tired and preoccupied, exhibiting no interest in her fellow travelers. At one point she winced, pressing a fist into the small of her back. Two others joined us, a portly gentleman in a business suit toting a briefcase and a garment bag, and a young girl in a ski parka with a bulging backpack. A few cars passed at speed sufficient to create an exhaust-laden breeze that swirled around our feet. At this hour of the morning, air traffic had diminished, but I could still hear the dull rumble of jets taking off from time to time. Several courtesy shuttles passed us in succession. She made no move to flag them down, nor did the other two waiting with us. Finally, a red van swung around the curve into view. On the side, in flowing gold script, "The Desert Castle" was written with a symbolic castle depicted in silhouette. Laura Huckabee raised a hand, signaling the van. The driver spotted the gesture and pulled over to the curb. He stepped out of the bus and helped the businessman with his luggage while she and I got on the bus, the businessman following. The young woman with the backpack remained where she was, her gaze still focused anxiously on approaching vehicles. I found a seat near the rear of the darkened bus. Laura Huckabee ended up near the front, her cheek propped wearily against the palm of her hand. Most of her hair was straggling out of her topknot. The driver returned to his seat and closed the door, then picked up a clipboard and turned halfway toward us to confirm the names on his list.
"Wheeler?"
"Here,"
the man in the business suit identified himself.
"Hudson?"
To my surprise, Laura Huckabee raised her hand.
"Hudson? Where did that come from?"
Interesting development. Not only had she deplaned in a city that was not her intended destination, but she'd apparently made hotel reservations in another name. What was she trying to pull? "I'm meeting someone," I said, speaking up in response to his inquiring look. The driver nodded, set the clipboard aside, put the bus in gear, and took off. We followed a complicated course of crisscrossing lanes around the terminal and finally sped through the open countryside. The land was flat and very, very dark. An occasional lighted building shot up out of the blackness like a shimmering mirage. We passed what might have been Restaurant Row, steakhouse after steakhouse, as gaudily lighted as one of the main streets in Las Vegas. A big commercial hotel finally loomed into view, one of those tasteless facilities with the room price, $69.95, single occupancy, posted right below the name. The red neon letters of the Desert Castle appeared to empty of color and then fill up again. In subscript, the sign read, "Where you're guaranteed a good night's," spelled K-N-I-G-H-T apostrophe S, "sleep." "Oh, please." The logo consisted of the outline of two green neon palms flanking a red neon tower with crenellated battlements. We passed an oasis of tall palms that surrounded a mock-up of the tower depicted on the building, a structure of faux stone complete with an empty moat and drawbridge. When the shuttle pulled into the hotel's passenger loading area, I hung back until Laura Huckabee, a.k.a. Hudson, had been assisted to the curb. There didn't seem to be any bell humans on duty. The man in the business suit picked up his briefcase and his garment bag. The three of us moved into the lobby through revolving doors, with me bringing up the rear. Aside from the duffel, Laura Huckabee was without luggage. Inside, the Merry Old England motif had been given full play. Everything was crimson and gold, heavy velvet drapes, crenellated moldings, and tapestries hung from metal pikes sticking out of the castle walls. Just beyond the elevators, an arrow pointed the way to the restrooms, which were marked Lords and Damsels. At the reception desk, I made sure I was third in line, reluctant to attract Laura Huckabee's attention. Given the hotel rates, I could afford maybe 2-night stay, but I'd have to be careful about additional charges. I had no idea how long Laura Huckabee would be here. She completed the check-in procedure and crossed to the elevators with the duffel in tow. By craning my neck slightly, I could see that the bank of elevators had a vertical strip of lights, indicating the floor each elevator was on at any given moment of operation. She entered the first elevator, and once the door closed, I murmured, "I'll be right back," to no one in particular, and sped in that direction. The red light advanced systematically from floor to floor and stopped on 12. I returned to the counter just as the man ahead of me finished checking in and crossed to the elevator.